I think we might open this second seminar by picking up where your new president left off. I quote from the introduction to paper 115, which is one of the shortest introductions in the Urantia book. Quote, "With God the Father, sonship is the great relationship. With God the Supreme, achievement is the prerequisite to status. One must do something as well as be something." Elsewhere in the papers, they describe the three great milestones of human survival. Milestone number one confronts each of us right here on Earth. That is the acceptance of sonship. The second great milestone is one we must traverse before we can graduate from the University of Time and Space to matriculate as a freshman in the University of Eternity, and that is willingness to believe. This is described as the passport to Havona. But again, before we can get to paradise, we go up against a quantitative and qualitative challenge. Ability to comprehend is the passport to paradise. So even in our pursuit of the Universal Father, achievement sooner or later enters into the picture. And I think you've elected a very good president. I will now put in a commercial plug for Bud Kagan. I got here, I floated from Chicago by jet, and this is the only way to fly. It's quite safe, I understand. And starting about 11 o'clock yesterday until the first car started pulling up today, we've been discussing the Blue Book. This guy has got a real comprehension of this book. You're lucky. He not only has a good comprehension of it, I want $5 in cash money after this, bud. No checks, please. This is a cash deal. No credit cards either. He's got a knack for teaching. In other words, he can use homely illustrations. And I know where these come from. They come effortlessly. The best illustrations I've ever used on this book are illustrations I never thought of. They popped up. Don't give Bud any credit for this teaching ability. Just shame on him if he doesn't use it. Now, there are probably some things which he does rather indifferently for which he deserves great credit because he's putting forth great effort. For example, if I put a flint in a Zippo lighter, I deserve a lot of credit because I'm a mechanical moron, and a Zippo is probably the most complicated machine that I really understand. I would say you've got a good teacher here, and use him. He's full of what Andy Main would call pizzazz. You know, his afterburners are turned on. He's moving. He's swinging. And I think he's quite a dedicated guy. I think at times it may rock him a little bit, but then I think back to when I was Bud's age, and I got a lot of years to think back, and I don't think I was any more, I think I was about as shook at Bud's age as he is. And I don't compare myself with Bud, I compare myself age 30 with Bud, and I got a good green memory. The nice thing about the guy is he should live forever. I mean, after all, he's just turned 21, and so forth and so on. End of commercial for President Bud Kagan. We finished last year with the end of part one. You recall those grim five sessions we spent on page two in the Urantia book? We spent, 3, 6, 12, we spent 15 hours on page two. Because if you can understand page two, you don't have too much trouble elsewhere. And I got the sweetest letter from Marie. She wrote me not too long ago and said that she had been reading the book. And she now realized when she listened to those tapes that we were speaking English. I think Marie Methkin has more chilled steel guts than any person I've met in a long time, because she actually had the courage to sit through this, and she was a raw green freshman. And we were talking about some of the most difficult concepts in cosmology, metaphysics, and what have you. And you wouldn't give up. I think maybe those two martinis we had at lunch one day give you courage. This is real fun. You know, we did it before. We're going to do it again. How do you folks want to start? Do you want to take an overview of part one as a kickoff?
Yeah. Let's go back to page two again.
Do you want to talk about a lot of questions? Do you want a summary of page two?
Briefly, may I please?
Mm-hmm. I can do it very easily in about 50 hours.
Sans martini.
You'll recall, over on page two, it talks about total deity. And it gives the six levels on which total deity is functional. And it, pardon me, the seven levels. And then it suggests an eighth level on which total deity is functional only in a certain sense. What we're doing when we talk about page two, we start out talking about the paper entitled Deity and Reality. And that paper describes the beginning of all things. This paper describes how would it have been if it ever had actually started in sequence. Now, when you go back of the fourth level here, when you deal with statics, potentials, and associatives, apart from the creative function of deity, you are going back of reality. In other words, you're going back of Havona in the central universe. And we all want to do this because we all want to get a start. But when we attempt this start, we should understand that, like Alice, we are going through the looking glass. There really isn't any room there. It just seems to be a room. We are conceptually violating reality. We are saying, what was it like before there was an infinite spirit in the central universe? All right, let's go through the looking glass. This is what time sequence thinkers want to do. They want to go back to number one. And actually, we start with seven. We don't start with one. I visualize the static function of deity as a condition in which we are looking at infinity as a unity. There aren't any actuals or potentials yet. All actuals are as yet unexpressed. Potentials are something pre-potential, because a real potential exists as a potential only in relation to some actuality. I visualize the picture of infinity at this point. There is a nothingness. And what I'm looking at I'm looking at a fried egg against a cosmic backdrop. I like the concept fried egg because you can't be afraid of a fried egg. If I talk about the totality of absoluteness, this is a frightening term. But a fried egg, what's with a fried egg? Well, what's with a fried egg is that there's a nucleus and a cytoplasm. There's a yolk and a white. And the papers say you never can go back to the place where there was just a oneness, even in your thinking. You must assume a possible two-ness. In other words, the yolk of the fried egg symbolizes a possibility for self-will, and the white of the fried egg symbolizes the possibility for reaction to some volitional act. This fried egg doesn't stay together. As long as it's together quietly, then we have the static function of total deity. Now please remember, as we develop each of these succeeding functions, the earlier functions are still continuous. Deity still functions in a static, self-contained sense. None of these terminate. They all go on with further differentiations. Well, the next step is the appearance of something potential. I visualize that by watching the yolk of my egg move out away. from the white. And the white flows together. So now I've got two kind of circles. I've got a yellow circle and I've got a white circle. The yellow circle is the volitional part, which is separating itself from the unvolitional part. This is total absoluteness now, but it's separated. The yoke moved, the white didn't. The white couldn't move, no self-will. The yoke could move, it has self-will. Since this yoke moved, it qualified itself in some way. It separated itself. This is the qualified absolute. That which did not move is the unqualified absolute. But you don't stop with a two-way relationship, because if you say 1 plus 1, you have 3 factors there. You have a plus sign. The white and the yoke are still related. And the name which the papers give to the relationship between the deified and the undeified, between the qualified absolute, the yoke, and the unqualified absolute, the white, the name which the papers give to that relationship is the universal absolute, the unifier of that which has differentiated or separated. In the presence of the universal absolute, in a sense, the egg is still united, functionally united. Now, we have an actuality of the qualified absolute. We now have the potentiality of the unqualified absolute, and we have the unity between them. This is the appearance of potentials. This is the beginning of the jailbreak of the Universal Father. As he continues to be absolute, but one by one he strikes off the shackles of absoluteness so that he is not imprisoned in the awful prison of absoluteness. What the Father is doing at this point is what Acrimedes dreamt of in Syracuse long ago when he said, "Give me a place to stand and I'll move the earth." The Universal Father is getting a place to stand on. He is creating room for creatures like us to appear in. If he fills all things totally, there is no room for anyone else, is there? He is producing a void, because a void has a virtue. It can be filled. We were quoting Lao Tzu.
Yes.
And when you realize you don't know nothing, this is when you can start learning something. As Lao Tzu said, 600 BC in the Tao Te Ching, the virtue of an empty vessel is that it can be filled. Emptiness has a virtue. Ruth?
Is there any other philosophy or religion which gives a name to relationships?
No.
Comparable to...
No. None that I know.
Absolute. That seemed to me an original...
These relationships personalize. Idea. These relationships personalize. Here. When a human mind is impregnated by the invasion of a spirit adjuster, the relationship between the mind and the adjuster is the soul, a living reality. All these relationships tend to personalize. Conceptual relationships are personalized. When the Father and the Son jointly entertain an identical concept, they personalize that concept as a creator-son. Such was the origin of Michael of Nebadon, who once lived on earth as a carpenter. Divinity always seeks expression in personalization. And so this is unique, Ruth.
That's what I'm saying. It seems to me
such I'll tell you a what else.
Tremendous contribution.
I'll tell you what else is unique here.
The thought of the world.
These papers are unique in that they will not validate a monad. A monad is what we would have if we took our original egg in the raw state and scrambled it. That would be a monad, a homogeneous oneness. The papers will validate only a non-homogeneous oneness. Because the minute you start with a monad, you can't get off first base. What breaks the deadlock? You follow me? If there is a single oneness, how did it ever separate? Somewhere in here. here if I find it out, quote this.
Bill, page six, isn't it?
Well, you've got several places here. I was looking over in Deity and Reality. Is it on page six where they speak of the hypothetical static moment of eternity?
Yes, the concept of the I am, the original transaction, the theoretical.
Yeah. Over on page 1154, they say, I'll paraphrase it, when we violate reality and give you chronology for events in eternity, which is to say we describe them as though they'd happened in time, then we have to say that there was a time at which the yolk separated from the white. In other words, this is a separation of the infinite one from the infinitude. Infinite one is the qualified absolute or the yolk of the eight. The infinitude, this name suggests no personality, is the unqualified absolute. And then they say, please remember, the infinity still continues, which is to say the union of the two. The yoke has moved out away from the white, and yet on another level and in another sense, the yoke is still in the white. You follow me? These things happen on many levels. And then they say, you can look at it from this standpoint. The union is achieved by the function of the universal absolute, who makes it as though it had never separated. So you have three concepts there. It's still the way it was. It's separated, but is united as though it had not separated, and yet it's separated. Now look, if your thinking is troubled by things of this sort, I don't think I'd let it worry me, because we are engaged in unscrewing the inscrutable. And you will recall our discussion about the Bantu last year. We asked everyone to consider the problem of executing an assignment for the State Department, which is you go to Africa and you write a series of papers about a 2,000-page dissertation describing the American way of life. You've got a good interpreter. And you are now writing paper number 112, entitled The Functions of the New York Stock Exchange. This is part of the American way of life. Or the financial functions of Wall Street, a broader title we'll get. And you start in dictating, and pretty soon you get a feedback from the translator. No word in Bantu for common stock. No word for cumulative preferred. No word for convertible debentures. No word for debentures versus secured borrowings. No word for growth equities. So little by little, you start impairing your presentation. At one point, you consider eliminating this paper entirely, because little by little, as you perceive the limitations of Bantu, it dawns on you that you're going to describe a state fair with barter and exchange of produce and animals. And either you make that compromise or you omit the chapter. Now, we are much closer to the Bantu than the Divine Counselor is to the English language. The problem of translating from English to Bantu is simple compared to his problem. What is the tribe in Africa that has one, two, three, and many?
Many.
That's the numerical system. One, two, three, many. That's their counting. How are you going to differentiate between a large many and a small many? You know, between 100 and a million, there's still many. Little many, big many, so on. At any rate, we have now potentials have developed. I think at the third level, I visualize something taking place within the yolk. I think of the essence of the Father within the yolk as the eternalist reality we know. But there are realities which I conceptualize as being eternaler than other realities. In this sense, the eternal Son is eternaler than the infinite Spirit, who is eternal, and the Father is eternalist. It's ridiculous, isn't it? But we're working in Bantu now, and we're discussing common stocks. One, two, three, many, you know? At the associative level, I see it beginning when God divests himself of absolute personality. Here again, he is escaping the limitations of absolute personality. In this transaction, he constitutes himself Father of the absolute personality who is the Son. The universal Father is not the absolute personality. That is the eternal Son. The eternal Son is the pattern personality. All personality is fashioned after the similitude of this absolute pattern in varying degrees. The Father simply steps aside from the absolute personality. In so doing, he possesses himself a Father personality. And I can best understand that by thinking, if he can be Father of the absolute person, he can be Father of any person. At the same time, he builds the absolute machine. He builds it for the same reason that men build machines, to act as a material governor, to perform repetitive acts. This absolute machine is the Isle of Paradise. It's the only machine which the Father ever built personally. It is just as much a revelation of the Father, or of God, as is the eternal Son. The Father is the source of paradise as he is Father of the eternal Son. The eternal Son, then, is the universal Father, minus everything which is non-deity, extra-divine, and other than spiritual. This is why the Son remains as the everlasting revelation of the Father. Because when we want to know the Father, we want to know that aspect of the first source and center which is divine, which is deity, which is spiritual, and in the Son we see this and this only. This is concentrated in the Son. If you want to be puzzled by the first source and center, consider paradise. This also is a revelation of the first source and center. The first association, the original association, is between the qualified and unqualified absolute and between the Father and the eternal Son. This is not a completed association. Do you see what's happening over here in the yoke? The Father is beginning to fix it so that he no longer pervades the wholeness of the yoke. He no longer fills the qualified absolute. First, he separated himself from the unqualified absolute. Now he is differentiating himself within the qualified absolute. And this differentiation is completed at the fourth level of total deity function. When, standing on paradise, which is their actual power platform for operations, the Father and the Son unite in the first act of creation. And this results in the appearance of their infinite associate, the third person of deity, and the central universe of eternity. And this creative act completes existential associations, because at this point, the three deities, not as persons, but as a corporation, as the Paradise Trinity, now fill the yolk of the egg. And now we should change the name of the yolk. We should no longer call it the qualified absolute. We should use its currently functional name. This is the deity absolute, referred to in the papers. And now the Father has completed his jailbreak. He not only has separated himself from being diffused as a pantheistic deity throughout the totality of infinity, he first concentrates free will and sets up in opposition to it capacity to react. And then within the area of free will, within the area of total deity function, he further segregates himself so that now he's got a place to stand on, he's got associates he can work with, and the show can hit the road. This is the beginning of reality. At the fourth level, we hit reality. We're back through the looking glass into a real room. This is an imaginary exploration. And the mere fact that you can't get the square root of a minus one doesn't mean that the symbol small I doesn't perform a valuable function in mathematics. These are imaginary things we've been dealing with. From here on out, it's real. Because reality starts with seven absolute beings in existence. And qualified absolute, universal absolute, deity absolute. The first source and center, second source and center, paradise source and center, and third source and center. And one functioning universe consisting of the 21 satellites of paradise, 1 billion perfect worlds, and the dark space bodies encircling Havona. This is the beginning of eternity. We have now reached the dawn of eternity. We have now reached the unbeginning start of the first universe age. A universe age which has an end in time, but has no beginning in time. And we have been using such silly words as eternal, eternaler, and eternalist. But this is the way it would have happened had it happened in time. And since we think in terms of time, we cannot understand sequence apart from time. The papers admonish us that mind of the paradise level is perfectly aware of non-temporal sequence, just as much as they understand non-spatial area. But to us, sequence and time are inseparable. And the best way I can illustrate that is to tell you a little story from a fantasy written by a mathematician. It's called Flatland. And he portrayed a civilization existing in two dimensions. And they had mores and customs. The lowest order of life was an isosceles triangle. If you were a scaling triangle, you were insane. You just weren't you weren't equal, you know. And as you moved up with more and more sides, you moved higher and higher in the hierarchy. And there were those beings who called themselves circles, but it was believed that they merely had very many sides. Well, this particular isosceles triangle encountered a sphere, a three-dimensional object. And of course, as the sphere entered Flatland, it appeared a point. You know, it was tangent. And then as the sphere moved into Flatland, it appeared to be a growing circle until the diameter was in this two-dimensional deal. And then as it moved above Flatland, it shrunk until it was a dot and vanished. Now Flatland laid an angle like this. They had north, south, east, and west, and up and down. And the sphere tried to explain to the triangle how it was possible to go up without going north, but he never could. Because to the triangle, up and north were the same direction. And so it is with us. Sequence and time are absolutely inseparable in our experience. But this Flatland story helps me to understand that there could be sequence without time. We're talking about source relationships here. There's no question about it. The Son came from the Father. There's equally no question. There never was a time when God was not Father of the Eternal Son. This is a relationship in eternity which we are most crudely symbolizing by analogous relationships in time. But from here on out, we have time. The sequence is a temporal sequence, almost, not quite entirely. We'll discuss that. It's fun. The associative level is consummated in the Paradise Trinity. It goes on in other experiential trinities. The creative function of total deity inaugurates the Paradise Trinity, and it still goes on. Creation is the characteristic earmark of the birth of Avona, and creation is going on right out here in time and space, isn't it? The seven master spirits are of origin on the fourth level. They were created by the Infinite Spirit as the active agency. I think of the Infinite Spirit sat down and painted seven pictures. He painted the Father. That's Master Spirit number one. He painted the Son. He stood in front of a mirror and painted himself. That's Master Spirit number three. Then he sat down and looked at the picture of the Father and the Son. He said, what would they be like if they were one? He painted a composite portrait. That's Master Spirit number four. He said, well, what would it be like if the Father and I were merged? He painted a fifth portrait. This is Master Spirit number five. Well, he said, this one I haven't tried. What if the Son and I were like? He painted the sixth portrait. What would it be like if the third and second person of deity were one being? This is Master Spirit number six. Then he said, what would it be like if all three of us were merged as persons? This is not the Trinity now. This is a personal portraiture. These are not the three deities sitting down as the board of directors of Undivided Deity Incorporated. These are three people. They're not in the boardroom. They're down on the street. They're having lunch. Fried eggs they're eating, no doubt. This is Master Spirit number seven. Creation goes right on. And there comes a time when the creative act of the Paradise deities brings to a close the first universe age. In my own thinking, I date this from the creation of the 21 Ancients of Days. They tell us this is the technical beginning of the time universes. And they tell us that when we go up on Paradise, when we want to look out history, recorded history, this is the first historic event that's of record. Prior to this statement of fact of the creation of the 21 Ancients of Days, it's prehistory. The Eternals of Days, as their name suggests, started with Havona, and Havona started with the Infinite Spirit, and the Infinite Spirit, in testifying that Havona is as old as he is, simply says, we're both eternal. There was no point in time when they started. The second universe age, the one we're in now, is the age of the evolutionary seven super universes. And now we hit the fifth level of total deity function. But there's an overlap. Creation still operates in the present universe age, but something new is added. Evolution. What is evolution? It is creativity in time. That's all. How does it differ from pre-evolutionary techniques of transferring potentials into actuals? It differs in a very simple way. Creatures can go into partnership with the creators now. If this thing is going to happen by fiat, how can you understand it as a creature? But if it happens slowly, then you can participate in the evolutionary process. No Havona native ever went into partnership with God to evolve to become a Havona native, did he? He was born a Havona native. critters like us can go into partnership with God in the evolution of ourselves as we are to be. This is a partnership arrangement. It produces that tremendous difference between the evolutionary and the created types, which is outlined in one of the papers on the Universal Father. I always have trouble with these because it can be anywhere in the latter papers. Yes. In page 51, they take inventory of what I have come to call the inevitabilities. And they point out that much of that which harasses us is inevitable. It's inherent in our status. You want courage, altruism, hope, faith, love of truth, idealism, loyalty, unselfishness, pleasure. Then, in order to have these things, you must be confronted with the alternatives. You must make a choice. If you could know everything, you couldn't have faith. This is knowledge. If there were no fear, how could there be any hope? If you couldn't be an SOB, then how could you be loyal at our level? If there weren't any pain, would we comprehend pleasure? This is inevitable if you're going to have an evolutionary technique, and you can't have creature partnership with deity by any other method than to slow down this creative process and keep it from being instantaneous so that creatures can understand what's happening. These things then become inevitable. And on the next page, they further discuss why these are inevitable. If you're going to have a creature and not a robot, then you must endow that creature with free will. And if you endow unwise, immature creatures with free will, tragedy becomes inescapable. And then they discuss, why isn't this true in the central universe, on the second paragraph? And then, in the third paragraph, they make this marvelous contrast between the hopefulness of a Havona native and the exquisite trust of an ascending morning. The calm expectancy of a pleasant future on the part of a Havona native who knows absolutely nothing about the precarious hope that we hang on to living down here on this uncertain ball of mud. They point out that this Havona native is just naturally kind. But he never rawhided a belligerent self to get himself into this frame of mind. He never let altruism triumph over unmitigated selfishness. He points out that the Havona natives, sure, they're loyal to the Trinity, but they've never really known what it was like to hang on with the skin of your teeth and be loyal. In other words, the Havona natives would have held Thermopylae as a matter of course, but the Spartans knew they could be killed. It's a difference in degree. Are we better than they are? No. We're different. Without them as a pattern, how the dickens would we get to paradise?
Yes. Sir, may I please ask, is not also free will a difference of degree?
Yes.
Would you
it's proportional.
Elaborate just a bit
on
free will?
I think free will is proportional to the choice possibilities of the creature. I think each person has as much free will, can activate as much free will as he needs to. And I think this grows. For example, I think the range of choice of a creator son is colossal, utterly colossal, not absolute. Because he too must choose within the framework of that which is choosable by a sub-paradise deity. I think the range of the father's free will is the greatest of all. It's limited only by his nature. He could not choose an ungodlike thing. He could not choose an evil thing. I think his sons could, but they don't. This loyalty business is beginning to appear on all sub-absolute levels. I think we have as much free will as we can use. I think this. Let's set up a sliding scale. And at one end, let's put outward things at the material level. And at the other end of the scale, let's put inward things culminating in the spiritual level. Does that scale make sense? In other words, we have all kinds of choices, some of which have to do with things outside of us and things. If super things are involved, more than things, then I think we have a greater range of choice, even on outside realities. But then I want to come from the outside, starting with material things, moving still outside towards super material things like people, who are more than just matter, coming little by little inward, and then once we get on the inside, moving upward towards spiritual things. At the outer extreme of the scale, I have least choice. My choice is extremely constrictive. I can't choose to be other than my present age. I can't choose to be other than a male of the species, which means I will never know what life looks like to the other half of the human race, the female. I have some choice out there. I cannot avoid the appearance of wrinkles in my face, but I do have a choice as to which kind. If I frown all my life, I'll get one kind. If I grin most of the time, I'll get another. The wrinkles are beyond my choice, but the type of wrinkles I can choose. Are you with me?
Oh, yes.
Now, as I come inwardly, my choice range is freer. As I move on the inside of me upward from material problems to philosophic, psychological, sociological problems, I have a greater range of choice. As I move up to the moral level, the ethical level, my choice range becomes even greater. And as I move spiritward, this range of choice becomes greater and greater until I reach the question of God. And at that point, I have absolute liberty. It would have to be that way. At that point, my choice range is absolute. It is totally unfettered. And it is that way because God has willed it to be that way. Where He is concerned, I can tell Him to go to hell, or I can try to serve Him all the days of my life. And if it's anything less than that, the whole damn thing is phony. I've got to have that range of choice, or I'm a robot. And He's up there with strings. And I know I'm not. I'm a son.
Thank you. That's a wonderful explanation.
Having thus provided for the growth of the immortal soul, and having liberated man's inner self from the fetters of absolute dependence on antecedent causation, the Father stands aside. Now, man having thus been liberated from the fetters of causation response, at least as pertains to eternal destiny, and provision having been made for the growth of the immortal self, the soul, it remains for man himself to will the creation or to inhibit the creation of this surviving and eternal self, which is his for the choosing. No other being, force, creator, or agency in all the wide universe of universes can interfere to any degree with the absolute sovereignty of the mortal free will as it operates within the realms of choice regarding the eternal destiny of the personality of the choosing mortal. As pertains to eternal survival, God has decreed the sovereignty of the material and mortal will, and that decree is absolute.
What page is that?
71. At the bottom of that page it says, the portal of survival opens only in response to the free will choice of the free will sons of the God of free will. It's a charter of liberty. At the same time, quite the damnedest challenge that could be issued to queer graduate mammals like us. We're pretty mammalian, you know?
Yes.
We're not quite complete animals. It's in this sense that we're made in the image of God. It's in this sense that he can call us sons. God, to me, is an affectionate being, very adventurous, very exploratory. People are this way. This is a kinship which we share with the Father of all. He likes to go adventuring. Otherwise, why didn't he leave the fried egg alone? He didn't have to. We like to adventure. We sometimes get our fingers burned and hold back a little bit, but basically in every normal human heart is the craving for growth and adventure.
There is a bit in here about the conflict between animal and man.
Sure.
I've had a page that I was on, there was one paragraph, you remember, that we thought summed up beautifully.
The conflict between man and animal is in part two in the Universe Mother Spirit, where it deals with the spirit and the flesh. I have trouble with this. My book is bound in four. This is in three. You're probably fishing for 382, or thereabout.
Yes.
I'll tell you. You can read the book. Let me give you my distillate of what that book means to me. I think religion, a real living religion, can use philosophy for its outer works, not for its inner bastion. And there are two Occidental philosophies that appeal greatly to me. They're supposed to be antagonistic, but in my own thinking, I find them complementary. One is Epicureanism, and the other is Stoicism. When things are rough, I find it easy to be a tactical Stoic. Strategically, I'm a religionist, but tactically, I'm a Stoic. You shrug and you say, c'est la vie. This is the way life is. The cookie is crumbling this way, you know? Have at it. For much of this, I find is sub-prayerful problem solving. This is just use human resources. And Stoicism puts a premium on courage and the response, the moral response to duty. I think a Stoic can be a frightful blue nose if he stops there. I don't see that Marcus Aurelius had very many kicks in life. He was a good princeps. He went up into Czechoslovakia and smacked the krauts around and was a damn fool when it came to succession. I think the Epicureans have something to sell, too. I don't think that the life carriers designed human life down here and equipped it with a sensory mechanism just to frustrate it. I love steak that's black on the outside and red on the inside, and I don't feel the least sinful when I cut into one of those with the juices flowing on the plate and in my mouth at the same time. I see no reason why I should not. I'm a material being. I got a material world to live in. I think I'm to enjoy it. I don't think I'm to worship it. But I think it's here to have fun in. And I think much of what we consider, well, what is it it says? Anything that's any fun is either sinful, fattening, or intoxicating.
Immoral,
that's right. Well, I'm an Epicurean. I love this life. It's fun. I get kicks out of it. I enjoy the material aspect and beauty of life. I enjoy people.
Were you born that way, or did you have to work on your Zippo to get it to this state of mind?
It took a little pounding. A little pounding. Now, I don't see that Epicureanism works too well in adversity. And I've lived through some years that have had some rather large lumps in them. I think Stoicism is very handy then. What's the matter with both of them? I build my castle with three sets of defense works. My outer works are Epicurean, because that's where the waves of circumstance beat them most often. I enjoy life. If those defenses go down, I have the defenses of Stoicism. These are my outer works. Now, if those should go down, I've got an inner keep. And the foundations of that inner keep have nothing to do with this temporal world, or any institution, or any person. This is my personal love for God and my absolute trust in Him. I know that nothing serious can go wrong with me. This doesn't mean that I can't get maimed, mangled, experience all kinds of pain. Look at what John the Baptist went through. That's not serious. That only lasts a little while. At the spiritual level, I know. At any other level, I'll guess with you. You know? Which way will the coin flip?
Bill, you just defined Jesus how he is.
Maybe. That's my own words. I know this, that if I'm in real trouble and I can't make it, I'll get help. This I know. But I don't go running to God every time I get my feelings hurt, you know. I think I'm a big boy. I should cope with most of these things on my own. I'm very diffident about talking about these things, my problems. I much rather discuss the pleasant aspects of life with God. He gave me two hands, a fairly decent brain, and free will, relative free will. I think he expects me to cope, you know? And I don't think I should ask my father to do my homework for me unless I'm really stuck. If I'm really stuck, I'll ask him. That's what I get a father for. There's a difference between courage and audacity. I don't expect my father to take care of me in any place I can take care of myself. But if I can't take care of myself, you're doggone right, I count on it. But most of my life, I depend on my own resources.
Would you think concerning relative free will that you could redefine it as if you have a capacity for a gallon of it, you get a gallon and a half?
Sure.
If you have a capacity for 10 gallons of it, you might get 15.
That's right. I think you got more than you can use.
That's right.
Here. If I'm going to get any help, it will be after I've helped myself. And the most perfect illustration I can think of is Andon and Fonda. It was very necessary for those two little savages to cut loose from their animal level tribe. This could have been fatal to the genes. And pressure grew up, jealousy. The twins were brighter, you know. And finally they decided to flee. Now that was strictly their decision. They used nothing but their own human equipment, including the fact that they were personalities. Then the life carriers introduced into their thinking the idea of northward. The twins had no geography. They didn't know what this world was like. It was very important that they not muff this. They got help. Fleeing was their decision. Northward was given to them. And this to me is a good illustration of how human beings get help when they need help. Of course, I think most of the help that human beings think they get from themselves. I think when a man prays honestly and sincerely for the solution to that problem, such prayer is both psychological and spiritual. And many times, the solution of the problem comes about because he has done, through prayer, a better job of mobilizing his purely human resources. This produces a result, and he can prove he got an answer. But I'm not so sure the answer came from God. It may have come from within himself. Ruth?
The second condition of effective prayer, you must have honestly exhausted the human capacity for
sure.
Human adjustment.
Right.
You must have been industrious.
This is what evolution means. This is the great difference in principle between Havona and Orvantan. In Havona, it's always been good. It couldn't be otherwise. In Orvantan, it has always been rough. It couldn't be otherwise. Because we're forging things out. Evil appears in Orvantan for the first time. Because all of a sudden, imperfect critters can make choices. And the least that can happen is evil and disharmony and maladjustment, misadaptation, ugliness. And the worst that can happen is sin and iniquity. Sin arrives, I think, when a creature is so foolish as to fall in love with the equipment which God has given him, namely personality. It's a tremendous endowment. And it's so tremendous that people can fall in love with it. It comes from God. This is self-love. And when self-concepts finally dominate a human being, this disrupts the atomic organization of life. Because then the central spirit nucleus no longer exercises governing power over this leading system. And that's the adjuster.
Would you please define self-love?
Self-love is when you decide that this universe is just for you. Self-love is when you lose the desire to do good to others, and you try to trap all this love and hold it within yourself. Self-love is when you disrupt the ever-flowing circuit of love, and the circuit of love comes from the Father through his sons to mortal creatures. And these mortal creatures should then love each other. And in so doing, they reveal the love of the Supreme. And the circuit is closed as that love returns to the Supreme from deity through creatures to deity. When you break that circuit, you stop the outflow. And then you become as the Dead Sea is, the Sea of Galilee. There is no outflow in the Dead Sea. It's a crude illustration.
Oh, it's lovely. I think it's a wonderful illustration.
At the evolutional level, something else happens. All this growth becomes possible because God launches a new venture. He has associated with himself two existential deities. This is the, you might say, the society of deity. You know, if God didn't have the Son and the Spirit, he'd be lonesome. Who would he talk to? Who would understand him? It takes infinity of capacity to understand God. And there are two beings who have such infinity of capacity, the second and third person of deity. Could he get by with one? It wouldn't be good. God could enjoy a partnership with the Son, but a social group requires a minimum of three members. And as they say in paper 10, this is the least important of all the reasons for the Trinity, but it is a reason. There is an infinite society, and there are three members. Having enjoyed the association of existential deity, the Father goes adventuring in a new area. let's open up our club to experiential deity. And so, at step four, we have a new deity appearing in potential. At some moment in time, the spirit person of the Supreme Being appeared. And this is a statement of fact. We are not being allegorical now. The origin of the Supreme Being dates back a large number, but a finite number of years ago. We're not hypothesizing now. This number could be expressed mathematically. We'd probably use exponents to do it. It would take too much space to write it. Later on in our seminar, I'll give you my calculations as to the age of Orvandan. I've made them. And I have some logic behind it, too. The Supreme Being starts as a spirit person somewhere in Havana. He is emerging outward as the collector and the correlator and the totalizer of all of this evolutionary process that we've been considering. And this evolutionary process starts at the human level with the action of the last two adjutant mind spirits, because they repercuss in their mother, the creative spirit. And when you get to her, you can see how it could reach the Supreme Being. Every good thing that everyone does in the grand universe contributes to the growth of the Supreme Being. I thought of it this way. If I stand up and pick up a chair, two things happen. My muscles are used. This is mine. But my feet push down against the floor just as hard as I lift it up, right? The down thrust belongs to the Supreme Being. Every decision which we make that is of moral, no, maybe moral, I would debate morality, but certainly every spiritual decision we make repercusses in the Supreme Being. Similarly, cancer can break out in the living organism of the grand universe. An infection can break out. That's a better illustration. What happens in your body when you get an infection? Well, your white leukocytes get on their horses. These are the guys with the white hats. They're good guys. And they build a wall around this infected area. They wall it off. Just exactly like they walled this planet off when we got into trouble. This Lucifer rebellion didn't affect the Father's bestowal of thought adjusters, the Son's spirit gravity, the ministry of mind. The paradise deities were immune to this, but not the Supreme Being. He is vulnerable to these things. You cannot hurt the being of the Universal Father. You can probably make him sorrow for you, but you can't hurt his growth because it's a finished thing. You can hurt the growth of the Supreme Being. You can actually scar him because he is dependent on evolutionary success. This is the personalization, powerization, evolution, totalization of everything that's going on out here in time and space, including Havana now, because Havana is tied into us. Havana has never been the same since the beatniks from time and space first landed. It's changed Havana. When Grand Fonda landed, the first of the graduate guides was born. The secondary supernafem began to appear in large numbers. Paradise citizens invaded the inner circuit, as the pilgrims from time and space hit the outermost circuit. Even the Havana natives began to exhibit evolutionary trends in Havana. Evolution invaded the central universe from the super universes, just as perfection invaded the super universes from the central universe. this supreme being is going to grow all through the present universe age. This second universe age has an origin in time. It'll have an ending in time. Consider what it's going to be like when every world, everywhere, is settled in light and life. We've studied this paper on settlement in light and life. I can't visualize what it's like in the later eras, but just think, where the taxation is easy, and they take 30% of the tax money and spend it on truth, 30% on beauty, 30% on the promotion of goodness, and 10% they put into the insurance reserves for people who have accidents. What a simple government. They don't have any armies, navies, because they've long since lost all need for a police force. And believe me, the police will wither before the army withers. Think what such a creation is like. 7 trillion inhabited worlds, more or less. Each one utopia. Each one having earned utopia. Each one having developed a distinct flavor. What is this flavor? This flavor is the residue of imperfection, which gives each world its characteristic bouquet. Different whiskies have different flavors, and those flavors are due to the impurities, not to the alcohol. Each of these worlds will have its trace of one-time impurity, which will make it different from any other of these trillion worlds. This again is following the pattern of Havona, there by fiat of creation. Each world was made wholly unique, so much so that when we've seen all of these billion worlds except the last one, we will be wholly unprepared for the surprise of the last Havona world we ever visit. You see, the Universal Father is not interested in the dead level of standardization. He's not trying to make everything uniform. It seems to me that he puts a tremendous premium on diversity. He's lavish with expenditure in order to get uniqueness. If the mathematics isn't clear, consider just what takes place in human conception with the steeplechase of the sperms, and how many hundreds of thousands of them are there, and only one is going to be the victor. I think the second universe age will end whenever the 7 super universes are settled in light and life. And I think this means the end of the growth of the Supreme. He will be a finished product. He will be contactable. He will exercise earned experiential sovereignty over the 7 super universes. And this is a sovereignty like that which Michael exercises over the local universe. In the beginning, Michael exercised no such sovereignty. He was what he was by virtue of the fact that he was a creator son. Now he rules because he has demonstrated his fitness to rule. He lived the finest human life that was ever lived in this local universe. He also proved 6 other times his fitness to rule. He has experientially established his sovereignty. It rests on an evolutionary, experiential foundation. He does not rule by divine right. He inaugurated his mission out here by divine right. The Supreme Being will rule as an experiential deity. And the Supreme Being is going to do for us something pretty important. He is going to be an understandable deity. He has an origin in time. Isn't that nice? We don't have to stretch and say, but he never really began. He began as we began. He grew as we have grown. We will understand the Supreme, and we will be expository of the Supreme. I hesitate to use the word revelatory. It's a little too potent. But we can explain him. because we're like him. We're evolutionary beings, for the same reason that Jesus could explain the universal Father, because he was like him, a divine creator. At the end of our present universe age, just think, evil, sin, is gone. Every world has achieved experiential perfection. It is a perfected world, in contrast to a Havona world, which is a perfect world. This is the appearance of what the papers call the secondary finite maximums, Havoners being primary finite maximums. We are finite incompletes now, but a seventh stage finaliter would be a secondary finite maximum. A sixth stage finaliter isn't a completed being yet. He's still growing. He's on third base, though.
I'm mixed up.
That's not strange.
This is where I was last year.
these are the two. This is the end of the. This is like point and counterpoint, or thesis and antithesis. A primary finite maximum is a being born in perfection, created in perfection. A secondary finite maximum is a being who starts out by evolution and achieves equality of perfection. He's gone the full route. He is now the peer of this primary. These are coordinate beings. We won't discuss tertiary finite maximums. That'll confuse you a little more. But tertiary finite maximums are creature trinitized sons. Now, does the thing stop there? No, there's another level. I should put undivided deity incorporated on the blackboard again. We used this illustration last year, and it's been pretty well received. Let's consider a firehouse, and I want a firehouse because I want that pole with the fireman slide down. That's the dotted line. It's a three-story firehouse. When we talked about everything on the other side of the looking glass, we were discussing the third floor strictly, nothing but the third floor. The minute creation started, we're dealing with the next two floors. Because at the creative level, God projected two levels which were to stand in contrast to the absolute level. First, he projected the finite level. And the finite level is characterized by time, space, and experience. Now, the absolute level is timeless, spaceless, and existential.